Chapter 24. A Time for Iron. A dozen leagues east of Abu Dar, Rakan glided in out of the cloud-streaked sunrise to land in a long pasture marked as the Flyer's Field, by colored streamers on tall poles. The brown grasses had been trampled and scored days since. All of the creature's grace in the air was lost as soon as their claws touched the ground in a lumbering run, leathery pinions 30 paces or more wide held high as if the animal wanted to sweep itself back upward. There was little beauty, either, in the Rakan that ran awkwardly down the field, beating ribbed wings, Flyers crouching in the saddle as if to pull the beast up by main force, ran on until at last they stumbled into the air, wingtips barely clearing the tops of the olive trees at the end of the field. Only as they gained height and turned toward the sun, soared toward the clouds, did the Rakan regain dignified grandeur. Flyers who landed did not bother to dismount. While a groundling held a basket up for the Rakan to gulp whole shriveled fruits by the double handful at a time, one of the Flyers would hand down their scouting report to a still more senior groundling, and the other bent on the other side to receive new orders from a Flyer too senior to handle reins personally very often. Almost that quickly after coming to a halt, the creature was reined around to waddle over to where four or five others waited their turn to make that long, ungainly run to the sky. At a dead run, dodging between moving formations of cavalry and infantry, messengers carried the scouting reports to the huge red-bannered command tent. There were haughty Terrabanner lancers and stolid Amadisian pikemen in well-ordered squares, breastplates striped horizontally in the colors of the regiments they were attached to. Altaran light horse, in disordered bunches, made their mounts prance, vain of the red slashes crisscrossing their chests, so different from the markings anyone else wore. The Altarans did not know those indicated irregulars of doubtful reliability. Among the Seanchan soldiers, named regiments with proud honors were represented from every corner of the empire. Pale-eyed men from Alkam, honey-brown men from Enkon, men black as coal from Koweal and Dalinshar. There were Marat Torm, on their sinuous, bronze-scaled mounts that made horses whicker and dance in fright, and even a few Marat Grolm, with their squat, beak-mouthed charges. But one thing that always accompanied a Seanchan army was conspicuous by its absence. The Suldam and Damani were still in their tents. Captain General Kenamiraj thought of the Suldam and Damani a great deal. From his seat on the dais he could see the map table clearly, where helmetless under-lieutenants checked the reports and placed markers to represent the forces in the field. A small paper banner stood above each marker, inked symbols giving the size and composition of the force. Finding decent maps in these lands was next to impossible, but the map copied atop the large table was sufficient, and worrying in what it told him. Black disks for outposts overrun were dispersed. Far too many of those, dotting the whole eastern half of the Venir Range. Red wedges for commands on the move marked the western end as thickly, all pointed back toward Abu Dar. And scattered among the black disks, 17 stark white. As he watched, a young officer in the brown and black of a Marat Torm carefully placed an 18th. Enemy forces. A few might be the same group seen twice, but for the most part, they were much too far apart. The timing of the sightings wrong. Along the walls of the tent, clerks in plain brown coats, marked only with insignia of rank among clerks on the wide collars, waited at their writing tables, pens in hand, for Miraj to issue orders that they would copy out for distribution. He had already given what orders he could. There were as many as 90,000 enemy soldiers in the mountains, nearly twice what he could muster here, even with the native levies. Too many for belief, except that scouts did not lie. Liars had their throats slit by their fellows. Too many, springing out of the ground like trapworms in the Sentajor. At least they had 100 miles of mountain yet to cover, if they intended to threaten Abu Dar. Almost 200, for the white disks furthest east. And hill country after that for another 100 miles. Surely the enemy general could not mean to let his dispersed forces be confronted one by one. Gathering them together would take more time. Time alone was on his side right then. The entry flaps of the tent swept open, and the High Lady Suroth glided in, black hair a proud crest spilling down her back, pleated snow-white gown and richly embroidered overrobe, somehow untouched by the mud outside. He had thought her still in Ebu Dar. She must have flown out by Torakhan. She was accompanied by a small entourage, for her. A pair of death-watch guards with black tassels on their sword-hilts held the tent flaps, and more were visible outside. Stone-faced men in red and green. The embodiment of the Empress, might she live forever. Even the blood took note of them. Surath sailed past as if they were as much servants as the lushly bodied Dakavale in slippers and a nearly transparent white robe, her honey-yellow hair in a multitude of thin braids, who carried the High Lady's gilded writing desk, a meek 2 paces behind. Surath's voice of the blood, Alwyn, a glowering woman in green robes, with the left side of her head shaved and the remainder of her pale brown hair in a severe braid, followed close on her mistress's heels. As Miraj stepped down from the dais, he realized with shock that the second Dakavale behind Surath, short and dark-haired and slim in her diaphanous robe, was Damani. A Damani garbed as property was unheard of, but odder still, it was Alwyn who led her by the Edam. He let none of his amazement show, as he went to one knee, murmuring, "The light be upon the High Lady Surath. All honor to the High Lady Surath." Everyone else prostrated themselves on the canvas groundcloth, eyes down. Miraj was of the blood, if too low to shave the sides of his scalp like Surath. Only the nails of his little fingers were lacquered, much too low to register surprise if a High Lady allowed her voice to continue acting as Suldam after being raised to the Sojin. Strange times in a strange land, where the dragon reborn walked, and Marath Damani ran wild to kill and enslave where they would. Surath barely glanced at him before turning to study the map table, and if her black eyes tightened at what she saw, she had cause. Under her, the Hylene had done far more than had been dreamed, reclaiming great stretches of the stolen lands. All they had been sent for was to scout the way, and after Falma, some had thought even that impossible. She drummed fingers on the table irritably, the long blue-lacquered fingernails on the first two clicking. Continued success, and she might be able to shave her head entirely and paint a third nail on each hand. Adoption into the imperial family was not unheard of for achievements so great. And if she stepped too far, overstepped, she might find her fingernails clipped and herself stuffed into a filmy robe to serve one of the blood, if not sold to a farmer to help till his fields, or sweat in a warehouse. At worst, Miraj would only have to open his own veins. He continued to watch Surath in patient silence, but he had been a scout lieutenant, Morat Rakan, before being raised to the blood, and he could not help being aware of everything around him. A scout lived or died by what he saw, or did not, and so did others. The men lying on their faces around the tent, some hardly seemed to breathe. Surath should have taken him aside and let them continue with their work. A messenger was being turned back by the soldiers at the entrance. How dire was the message that the woman tried to push past Death Watch guards. The Dakavale with the writing desk in her arms caught his eye. Scowls flashed across her pretty doll's face, never pushed down for more than moments. Property showing anger? And there was something else. His gaze flickered to the Damani, who stood with her head down, but still looked around with curiosity. Brown-eyed Dakavale and pale-eyed Damani looked about as different as two women could, yet there was something about them, something in their faces. Strange. He could not have said how old either was. Quick as his glance was, Alwyn noticed. With a twitch of the Edam's silvery leash, she put the Damani face down on the groundcloth. Snapping her fingers, she pointed to the canvas with a hand not encumbered by the Edam's bracelet, then grimaced when the honey-haired Dakavale did not move. "Down, Leandrin," she hissed almost under her breath. With a glare for Alwyn, a glare, the Dakavale sank to her knees, features painted with sulkiness. "Most strange, but hardly important." Face impassive and otherwise bursting with impatience, he waited. Impatience and no little discomfort. He had been raised to the blood after riding 50 miles in a single night with 3 arrows in him to bring word of a rebel army marching on Shandar itself, and his back still pained him. Finally, Siroth turned from the map table. She did not give him leave to rise, much less embrace him as one of the blood. Not that he had expected that. He was far beneath her. "You are ready to march?" she demanded curtly. At least she did not speak to him through her voice. Before so many of his officers, the shame would have put his eyes on the ground for months, if not years.
"I will, Siroth,"
he replied calmly, meeting her gaze. He was of the blood, however low.
"They cannot combine in fewer than 10 days, with at least another 10 before they can exit the mountains. Well before then, I..."
"They could be here tomorrow," she snapped. "Today! If they come, Miraj, they will come by the ancient art of traveling, and it seems very possible that they will come."
He heard men shifting on their bellies before they could restrain themselves. Siroth lost control of her emotions and babbled of legends.
"Are you certain?"
The words popped out of his mouth before he could stop them. He had only thought she had lost control before. Her eyes blazed. She gripped the edges of her flower-worked robe, white-knuckled, and her hands shook.
"Do you question me?" she snarled incredulously. "Suffice it that I have my sources of information."
And was furious with them as much as with him, he realized.
"If they come, there will be perhaps as many as 50 of these grandly named Ashaman, but no more than 5,000 or 6,000 soldiers. It seems there have been no more since the beginning, whatever the flyers say."
Mirage nodded slowly. 5,000 men moved about in some way with the One Power would explain a great deal. What were her sources that she knew numbers so precisely? He was not fool enough to ask. She certainly had listeners and seekers in her service, watching her too. 50 Ashaman. The very idea of a man channeling made him want to spit in disgust. Rumor claimed that they were being gathered from every nation by the Dragon Reborn, this Randalthor, but he had never expected there could be so many. The Dragon Reborn could channel, it was said. That might be true, but he was the Dragon Reborn. The prophecies of the dragon had been known in Shanchan even before Luther Payandrag began the consolidation. In corrupted form, it was said, much different from the pure version Luther Payandrag brought. Mirage had seen several volumes of the Kariathon cycle printed in these lands, and they were corrupted too. Not one mentioned him serving the Crystal Throne, but the prophecies held men's minds and hearts still. More than a few hoped the return came soon, that these lands could be reclaimed before Tarmon Gaiden, so the Dragon Reborn could win the last battle for the glory of the Empress, might she live forever. The Empress surely would want Althor sent to her, so she could see what sort of man served her. There would be no difficulty with Althor, once he had knelt to her. Few easily shook off the awe they felt, kneeling before the Crystal Throne, with the thirst to obey drying their tongues. But it seemed obvious that bundling the fellow onto a ship would be easier if disposing of the Ashaman, they had to be disposed of, certainly, waited until Althor was well on his way across the Arath Ocean to Shandar. Which brought him back to the problem he had been trying to avoid, he realized with an inward start. He was not a man to shy from difficulties, much less ignore them blindly, but this was different from any he had faced before. He had fought in 2 dozen battles with Damani used on both sides. He knew the way of them. It was not only a matter of striking out with the power. Experienced Suldam could somehow see what Damani or Marath Damani did, and Damani would tell the others so they could defend as well. Could Suldam see what a man did, too?
Worse. "You will release the Suldam and Damani to me," he said.
Taking a deep breath in spite of himself, he added,
"If they're still sick, It will be a short fight and bloody on our side.
Which produced another stir among the men waiting on their faces. Every second rumor in the camp was about what illness had confined the Suldam and Damani to their tents. Alwyn reacted quite openly, most improper in a Sojin, with a furious glare. The Damani flinched again and began to shiver where she lay. Oddly, the honey-haired Dakavali flinched as well. Smiling, Siroth glided to where the Dakavali knelt. Why would she smile at a poorly trained serving girl? She began stroking the kneeling woman's thin braids, and a sullen pout appeared on that rosebud mouth. A former noblewoman of these lands? Siroth's first words supported that, though obviously meant for him.
Small failures bring small costs. Great failures bring painfully great costs. You will have the Damani you require, Mirage, and you will teach these Ashaman they should have remained in the north. You will wipe them from the face of the earth. The Ashaman, the soldiers, all of them. To the man, Mirage, I have spoken.
It will be as you say, Siroth, he replied.
They will be destroyed to the man.
There was nothing else he could say now. He wished, though, that she had given him an answer about whether the Suldam and Damani were still sick. Rand reined Taidashar around near the crest of the bare stony hill to watch most of his small army spilling out of other holes in the air. He held hard to the true source, so hard it seemed to tremble in his grasp. With the power in him, the sharp points of the crown of swords pricking his temples felt at once keener than ever and utterly removed, the mid-morning chill both colder and beneath notice. The never-healing wounds in his side were a dull and distant ache. Luz Theron seemed to be panting in uncertainty, or perhaps fear. Maybe after coming so close to death the day before, he did not want so much to die anymore. But then, he did not always want to die. The only constant in the man was the desire to kill, which just happened to include killing himself often enough.
They'll be killing enough for anybody soon, Rand thought. Light, the last 6 days were enough to sicken a vulture.
Had it only been 6 days. The disgust did not touch him, though. He would not let it. Luz Theron did not answer. Yes. It was a time for iron hearts, and iron stomachs, too. He bent a moment to touch the long cloth-wrapped package under his stirrup leather. No, not time yet. Maybe not at all. Uncertainty shimmered across the void, and maybe something else. Not at all, he hoped. Uncertainty, yes, but the other half had not been fear. It had not. Half the surrounding low hills were covered with squat, gnarled olive trees, dappled by the sunlight, where lancers already rode along the rows to make sure they were clear. There was no sign of workers in those orchards, no farmhouse, no structure of any kind in sight. A few miles to the west, the hills were darker, forested. Legion men, emerging in trotting files below Rand, formed up, trailed by a ragged square of Ilianar volunteers, now enlisted into the Legion. As soon as their ranks were aligned, they marched out of the way to make room for defenders and companions. The ground seemed mostly clay, and boots and hooves alike skidded in the thin skim of mud. For a wonder, though, only a few clouds hung in the sky, white and clean. The sun was a pale yellow ball, and nothing flew up there larger than a sparrow. Dashiva and Flynn were among the men holding gateways, as were Adley and Hopwill, Moore and Narishma. Some of the gateways lay out of Rand's sight, behind the folded hills. He wanted everyone through as quickly as possible, and except for a few soldiers scanning the sky, every man in a black coat who was not already out scouting held a weave. Even Gedwin and Rochide, though both grimaced over it, at each other and in his direction. Rand thought them no longer used to doing anything so common as holding a gateway for others to use. Bashir cantered up the slope, very much at ease with himself, and with his short bay. His cloak was flung back despite the morning's coolness, not so cold as the mountains, but still wintry. He nodded casually to Anaïla and Ailill, who gave bleak stares in return. Bashir smiled through those thick mustaches like down-curving horns, a not entirely pleasant smile. He had as many doubts of the women as Rand did. The women knew, about Bashir's reservations at least. Turning her head quickly from the Saldaean, Anaïla returned to stroking her gelding's mane. Ailill held her reins too rigidly. That pair had not strayed far from Rand since the incident on the ridge, even having their tents pitched in earshot of his the night before. On a brown grass hillside opposite, Denharad shifted to study the two noblewomen's retainers, arrayed together behind him, then quickly returned to watching Rand. Very likely he watched Ailill, and maybe Anaïla as well. But he watched Rand without doubt. Rand was unsure whether they still feared to take the blame if he was killed, or simply wanted to see it happen. The one thing he was certain of was that if they did want him dead, he would give them no opportunity.
"Who knows a woman's heart?" Luz Theron chuckled wryly. He sounded in one of his saner moods. "Most women will shrug off what a man would kill you for, and kill you for what a man would shrug off."
Rand ignored him. The last gateway in Rand's sight winked out. The Ashaman mounting their horses were too far for him to say for sure whether any still held on to Saideen, but it did not matter so long as he did. Clumsy Dashiva tried to mount quickly and nearly fell off twice before successfully reaching his saddle. Most of the black-coated men in view began riding north or south. The rest of the nobles gathered quickly with Bashir on the slope, just below Rand, the highest ranking and those with the most power in front, after a little jostling here and there, where precedence remained uncertain. Tahara and Markalin kept their horses on the fringes, on opposite sides of the mass of nobles, faces carefully blank. They might be asked for advice, but both knew the final decisions rested with others. Wyraman opened his mouth with a grand gesture, doubtless to begin another splendid peroration on the glories of following the Dragon Reborn. Sunaman and Torian, accustomed to his speeches and powerful enough to take no care around him, reined their horses together and began talking quietly. Sunaman's face wore an unaccustomed hardness, and Torian seemed ready to squabble over a boundary line, despite the red satin stripes on his coat sleeves. Square-jawed Bertome and some of the other Kyrianen were not quiet at all, laughing at each other's jokes. Everyone had had a bellyful of Wyraman's grand declamations. The Samaradrid's scowl deepened every time he looked at Ailill and Anaïla. He did not like them remaining close to Rand, especially his countrywoman. So perhaps his sourness had more root than Wyraman's windiness.
"About 10 miles from us," Rand said loudly, "a good 50,000 men are preparing to march."
They were aware of that, but it pulled every eye to him and silenced every tongue. Wyraman's mouth snapped shut sourly. The fellow did love to hear himself talk. Guayam and Marakan, tugging at sharp-oiled beards, smiled in anticipation. The fools. Samaradrid looked like a man who had eaten an entire bowl of bad plums. Gregorin and the three lords of the Nine with him merely wore grim determination on their faces. Not fools.
"The scouts saw no signs of Suldam or Damani," Rand went on. "But even without them, even with Ashaman, that's enough to kill a lot of us if anybody forgets the plan." "No one will forget, though, I'm sure."
No charges without orders this time. He'd made that clear as glass and hard as stone. No herring off because you thought maybe you just might have seen something either. Wyraman smiled, managing to put as much oil into it as Sunaman ever could. It was a simple plan in its way. They would advance west in 5 columns, each with Ashaman, and attempt to fall on the Shan Chan from every side at once. Or as close to all sides as could be managed. Simple plans were best, Bashir insisted.
"If you won't be satisfied with a whole litter of fat piglets," he had muttered, "if you have to rush into the woods to find the old sow, then don't get too fancy or she'll gut you."
"No plan of battle survives first contact," Luz Theron said in Rand's head. For a moment, he still seemed lucid. For a moment.
Something is wrong, he growled suddenly.
His voice began to gain intensity and drift into wild, disbelieving laughter.
It can't be wrong, but it is. Something strange. Something wrong. Skittering, jumping, twitching.
His cackles turned to weeping.
It can't be. I must be mad.
And he vanished before Rand could mute him.
Burn him. There was nothing wrong with the plan, or Bashir would have been on it like a duck on a beetle.
Luce Theron was mad, no doubt of it, but so long as Randall Thor remained sane. A bitter joke on the world if the Dragon Reborn went mad before the last battle even began.
Take your places, he commanded with a wave of the Dragon Scepter.
He had to fight down the urge to laugh at that joke. The large clump of nobles broke apart at his order, milling and muttering as they sorted themselves out. Few liked the way Rand had divided them up. Whatever breaking down of barriers had occurred in the shock of the first fight in the mountains, they had sprung up again almost immediately. Wireman frowned over his undelivered speech, but after an elaborate bow that thrust his beard at Rand like a spear, he rode north over the hills, followed by Kirill Drapaneos, Bertome, Duresen, and several minor Kyrianan lords, every last one of them stony-faced at a tyrant being placed over them. Gedwin rode by Wireman's side, almost as if he were the one leading, and got dark scowls for it that he affected not to notice. The other groupings were as mixed. Gregorin also headed north, with a sullen Sunamon trying to pretend he was heading in the same direction by happenstance, and Althanas leading lesser Kyrianan behind. Jordwen Samaris, another of the nine, followed Bashir south, with Amundrid and Gwayam. Those three had accepted the Saldaean almost eagerly, for the simple reason that he was not Tyran or Kyrianan or Ilioner, depending on the man. Rochide seemed to be trying the same with Bashir that Gedwin was with Wireman, but Bashir appeared to ignore it. A little way from Bashir's party, Torian and Marakon rode with their heads together, likely venting spleen at having Samaradrid placed over them. For that matter, Urshan Natari kept glancing toward Jordwin, and standing in his stirrups to look back toward Gregorin and Kirill, though it was improbable he could see them any longer past the hills. Samaradrid, his back iron rod straight, looked as unflappable as Bashir. It was the same principle Rand had used all along. He trusted Bashir, and he thought he might be able to trust Gregorin, and none of the others could dare think of turning against him, with so many outlanders around him, so many old enemies, and so few friends. Rand laughed softly, watching them all ride off from his hillside. They would fight for him and fight well, because they had no other choice, any more than he had.
Madness, Luce Theron hissed.
Rand shoved the voice away angrily. He was hardly alone, of course. Tihera and Markalin had most of the defenders and companions mounted in ranks among the olive trees on hills flanking the one where he sat his horse. The rest were out as a screen against surprise. A company of blue-coated legionmen waited patiently in the hollow below under Masson's eye, and at their rear, as many men in what they had worn surrendering on the heath back in Ilion. They were trying to emulate the legionmen's calm, the other legionmen now, trying without a great deal of success. Rand glanced at Ailill and Anaela. The Tyran woman gave him a simpering smile, but it faltered weakly. The Kyrianan woman's face was frost. He could not forget them, or Denharad and their armsmen. His column, in the center, would be the largest and the strongest by a fair margin. A very fair margin. Flynn and the men Rand had chosen out from Dumai's Wells rode up the hill toward him. The balding old man always led, though all save Adle and Arishma now wore the dragon as well as the sword, and Ashiva had worn it first. In part, it was because the younger men deferred to Flynn, with his long experience as a bannerman in the Andoran Queen's guards. In part, it was because Ashiva did not seem to care. He only appeared amused by the others. When he could spare time from talking to himself, that was. Most often, he hardly seemed aware of anything past his own nose. For that reason, it was something of a shock when Dashiva awkwardly booted his slab-sided mount ahead of the rest. That plain face, so often vague or bemused with the fellow's own thoughts, was fixed in a worried frown. It was more than something of a shock when he seized Sidene as soon as he reached Rand and wove a barrier around them against eavesdropping. Luce Theron did not waste breath, if a disembodied voice had breath, on mutters about killing. He lurched for the source, snarling wordlessly, tried to claw the power away from Rand, and just as abruptly fell silent and vanished.
"There's something askew with Sidene here. Something amiss," Dashiva said, sounding not at all vague. In fact, he sounded precise and testy. A teacher lecturing a particularly dense pupil. He even stabbed a finger at Rand. "I don't know what it is. Nothing can twist Sidene, and if it could be twisted, we'd have felt it back in the mountains. Well, there was something there yesterday, but so small. I feel it clearly here, though. Sidene is eager. I know Sidene is not alive, but it pulses here. It is difficult to control."
Rand forced his hand to loosen its grip on the dragon scepter. He had always been sure Dashiva was nearly as mad as Luce Theron himself. Usually the man maintained a better hold on himself, though, however precariously.
"I've been channeling longer than you, Dashiva. You're just feeling the taint more."
He could not soften his tone. Light, he could not go mad yet, and neither could they.
"Get to your place. We'll be moving soon."
The scouts had to return soon. Even in this flatter country, even limited to no further than they could see, 10 miles would not take long to cover traveling. Dashiva made no move to obey. Instead, he opened his mouth angrily, then snapped it shut. Shaking visibly, he drew a deep breath.
"I am well aware how long you have channeled," he said in an icy, almost contemptuous voice. "But surely even you can feel it." "Feel, man! I don't like strange," applied to Sidene, "and I don't want to die or be burned out because you're blind. Look at my ward. Look at it."
Rand stared. Dashiva pushing himself forward was peculiar enough, but Dashiva in a temper? And then he did look at the ward. Really look. The flows should have been as steady as the threads in tight-woven canvas. They vibrated. The ward stood solid as it should be, but the individual threads of the power shimmered with faint movement. Moore had said Sidene was strange near Ebu Dar, and for 100 miles around. They were closer than 100 miles now. Rand made himself feel Sidene. He was always aware of the power. Anything else meant death or worse. Yet he had become used to the struggle. He fought for life, but the fight had become as natural as life. The struggle was life. He made himself feel that battle, his life. Cold to make stone shatter into dust, fire to make stone flash to vapor, filth to make a rotten cesspit smell a garden in full flower. And a pulsing, like something quivering in his fist. This was not the sort of throbbing he had felt in Shadar-Logoth, when the taint of Sidene had resonated with the evil of that place, and Sidene had pulsed with it. The vileness was strong but steady here. It was Sidene itself that seemed full of currents and surges. Eager, Dashiva called it, and Rand could see why. Down the slope, behind Flynn, Moore scrubbed a hand through his hair and looked around uneasily. Flynn alternated shifting on his saddle and easing his sword in its scabbard. Narishma, watching the sky for flying creatures, blinked too often. A muscle twitched in Adli's cheek. Every one of them displayed some sign of nervousness and little wonder. Relief welled up in Rand. Not madness after all. Dashiva smiled, a twisted, self-satisfied smile.
"I cannot believe you didn't notice before."
There was very close to a sneer in his voice.
"You've been holding Sidene practically day and night since we began this mad expedition. This is a simple ward, but it did not want to form. Then it snapped together like pulling out of my hands."
The silver-blue slash of a gateway rotated open atop one of the bare hills, half a mile to the west, and a soldier pulled his horse through and mounted hurriedly, returning from the scout. Even at a distance, Rand could make out the faint shimmer of the weaves surrounding the gateway before they vanished. The rider had not reached the bottom of the hill before another gateway opened on the crest, and then a third, a fourth. More, one after another, almost as fast as the preceding man could get out of the way. But it did form, Rand said. So had the scout's gateways. If Cydene is hard to control, it's always hard. And it still does what you want. But why more difficult here? A question for another time. Light, he wished Herod Fell were still alive. The old philosopher might have had an answer. Get back with the others, Dashiva, he ordered. But the man stared at him in astonishment, and he had to repeat himself before the fellow let the ward vanish, jerked his horse around without a salute, and thumped the animal back down the slope with his heels.
Some trouble, my lord dragon? Anaela simpered.
Ailill merely looked at Rand with flat eyes. Seeing the first scout on the way toward Rand, the others fanned off to north and south, where they would join one of the other columns. Finding them the old-fashioned way would be faster than casting about with gateways. Drawing rein in front of Rand, Nalaam slapped fist to chest. Did he look a bit wild-eyed? No matter. Cydene still did what the man wielding it made it do. Nalaam saluted and gave his report. The Seanchan were not encamped 10 miles away. They were no more than 5 or 6 distant, marching east. And they had Suldam and Damani by the score. Rand issued his orders as Nalaam galloped away, and his column began moving west. The defenders and the companions rode on either flank. The legion men marched at the rear, just behind Anharad. A reminder to the noblewomen and their armsmen, if they needed one. Anaela certainly looked over her shoulder often enough, and Ailill's refusal to was pointed. Rand formed the main thrust of the column, Rand and Flynn and the others, just as it would be with the other columns. Ashaman to strike, and men with steel to guard their backs while they killed. The sun still had a long way to climb before midday. Nothing had changed to alter the plan.
Madness waits for some, Luthien whispered. It creeps up on others.
Mirage rode near the head of his army marching east along a muddy road that wound through hilly olive groves and patchy forest. Not at the head. A full regiment, most Seanchan, rode between him and the forward scouts. He had known generals who wanted to be at the very front. Most were dead. Most had lost the battles they died in. Mud kept down dust, yet word of an army on the move ran like wildfire on the Salas Plains, whatever the land. Here and there among the olive trees he spotted an overturned wheelbarrow or an abandoned pruning hook, but the workers had vanished long since. Luckily, they would avoid his opponents as much as they did him. With luck, lacking Rakan, his opponents would not know he was on them until it was too late. Kenemiraj did not like trusting to luck. Aside from under-officers ready to produce maps or copy orders, and messengers ready to carry them, he rode accompanied only by Abeldar Yulan, small enough to make his quite ordinary brown gelding seem immense, a fiery man with the nails of his little fingers painted green, who wore a black wig to conceal his baldness, and Lysane Jarrath, a gray-haired woman from Shandar itself, whose pale plump face and blue eyes were a study in serenity. Yulan was not calm. Mirage's cold dark captain of the air often wore a scowl for the rules that seldom let him touch the reins of a rockin' anymore, but today his frown went bone-deep. The sky was clear. Perfect weather for rockin', but by Siroth's command, none of his flyers would be in the saddle today, not here. There were too few rockin' with the Hylene to risk them unnecessarily. Lysane's calm troubled Mirage more. More than the senior Der Suldam under his command, she was a friend with whom he had shared many a cup of kaff and many a game of stones. An animated woman, always bubbling over with enthusiasms and amusement. And she was icy calm, as silent as any Suldam he had tried to question. Within his sight were 20 Damani flanking the horsemen, each walking beside her Suldam's mount. The Suldam bobbed in their saddles, bending to pat a Damani's head, straightening only to bend again to stroke her hair. The Damani looked steady enough to his eye, but plainly the Suldam were on razor's edge. And a bullient Lysane rode silent as a stone. A Torm appeared ahead, racing down the column. Well off to the side, on the edge of the groves, yet horses wickered and shied as the bronze-scaled creature flowed past. A trained Torm would not attack horses, at least not unless the killing frenzy overtook it. The reason Torm were no good in battle. But horses trained to become around Torm were in as short supply as Torm themselves. Mirage sent a skinny under-lieutenant named Varek to fetch the Morat Torm's scouting report. Afoot, and the light consumed whether Varek lost Saiter. He would not waste time on Varek trying to control a mount acquired locally. The man returned faster than he went, and made a crisp bow, beginning his report before his back was straight again.
"The enemy is less than 5 miles due east, my lord Captain General, marching in our direction. They are deployed in 5 columns, spaced approximately 1 mile apart."
So much for luck. But Mirage had considered how he would attack 40,000 with only 5 himself, and 50 Damani. Quickly, men were galloping with others to deploy to meet an attempted envelopment, and the regiments behind him began turning into the groves, Suldam riding among them with their Damani. Gathering his cloak against a sudden cold wind, Mirage noticed something that made him feel colder still. Lysane was watching the Suldam vanish into the trees, too, and she had begun to sweat. Bertome rode easily, letting the wind stream his cloak to one side, but he studied the forested country ahead with a wariness he barely attempted to conceal. Of his 4 countrymen at his back, only Duresin was truly skilled in the game of houses. That fool Tyran dog Wireman was blind, of course. Bertome glared at the puffed-up buffoon's back. Wireman rode well ahead of the rest in deep conversation with Gedwin, and if Bertome needed any further proof that the Tyran would smile at what gagged a goat, it was how he tolerated that hot-eyed young monster. He noticed Kirill glancing sideways at him and reined his gray further from the towering man. He had no particular enmity toward the Ilianer, but he did hate people looming over him. He could not wait to return to Kyrian, where he did not have to be surrounded by ungainly giants. Kirill Drapaneus was not blind, though, however overtall. He had sent 12 scouts forward, too. Wireman had sent 1.
"Duresin," Bertome said softly. Then a little louder, "Duresin, you lump!"
The bony man gave a start in his saddle. Like Bertome, like the other 3, he had shaved and powdered the front of his head. The style of marking yourself like a soldier had become quite fashionable. Duresin should have called him a toad in return, the way they had since boyhood, but instead he heeled his gelding up beside Bertome's and leaned close. He was worried and letting it show, his forehead furrowed deeply.
"You realize the Lord Dragon means us to die," he whispered, glancing at the column trailing behind them. "Blood and fire, I only listened to Kolaver, but I have known I was a dead man since he killed her."
For a moment, Bertome eyed the column of armsmen, snaking back through the rolling hills. The trees were more scattered here than ahead, but still enough to shield an attack until it was right on top of you. The last olive grove nearly a mile behind. Wireman's men rode at the 4, of course, in those ridiculous coats with their fat white-striped sleeves, and then Kirill's Ilianers in enough green and red to shame tinkers. His own people, decently clad in dark blue beneath their breastplates, were still beyond his sight, with Duresin's and the others, ahead only of the company of legionmen. Wireman had seemed surprised that the foot kept up, though he had hardly set a difficult pace. It was not really the armsmen Bertome glanced at, though. 7 men rode before even Wireman's, 7 men with hard faces and death-cold eyes in black coats. One wore a pin in the shape of a silver sword on his tall collar. "An elaborate way to go about it," he told Duresin dryly, "and I doubt Althor would have sent those fellows with us if we were just being fed into a sausage grinder." Forehead still creased, Duresin opened his mouth again, but Bertome said, "I need to talk to the Tyran." He disliked seeing his childhood friend this way. Althor had unhinged him. Absorbed in one another, Wireman and Gedwin did not hear him riding up on them. Gedwin was idly playing with his reins, his features cold with contempt. The Tyran was red-faced. "I don't care who you are," he was saying to the black-coated man in a low, hard voice, spittle flying. "I won't take more risk without a command direct from the lips of—" Abruptly, the pair became aware of Bertome, and Byraman's mouth snapped shut. He glared as if he wanted to kill Bertome. The Ashaman's ever-present smile melted away. The wind gusted, cold and sharp, as clouds drifted across the sun, but no colder than Gedwin's sudden stare. With a small shock, Bertome realized the man also wanted to strike him dead on the spot. Gedwin's icily murderous gaze did not change, but Wireman's face underwent a remarkable transformation. The red faded slowly as he produced a smile in an instant, an oily smile with only a trace of mocking condescension.
"I've been thinking about you, Bertome," he said heartily. "A pity Althor strangled your cousin. With his own hands, I hear. Frankly, I was surprised you came when he called. I've seen him watching you. I fear he plans something more interesting for you than thrashing your heels on the floor while his fingers tighten on your throat."
Bertome suppressed a sigh, and not only at the fool's clumsiness. A good many thought to manipulate him with Colivert's death. She had been his favorite cousin, but ambitious beyond reason. Saigon had good claims to the Sun Throne, yet she could not have held it against the strength of Rhiaton or Damodred, either one, let alone both together, not without the open blessings of the White Tower or the Dragon Reborn. Still, she had been his favorite. What did Wireman want? Certainly not what it seemed on the surface. Even this tyrant oaf was not that simple. Before he could frame any response, a horseman came galloping toward them through the trees ahead. A Kyrianan. And as he reined to a sudden halt in front of them, that made his horse sit back on its haunches, Bertome recognized one of his own armsmen, a gap-toothed fellow with seamed scars on both cheeks. Doyle, he thought, from the Colchain Estates.
"My lord Bertome," the fellow panted, bowing hastily. "There are 2,000 Terrabonners hard on my heels, and women with them, with lightning on their dresses." "Hard on his heels," Wireman murmured disparagingly. "We'll see what my man has to say when he gets back. I certainly don't see any—"
Sudden whoops in the near distance ahead cut him off, and the thunder of hooves, and then quickly galloping lancers appeared, a flowing tide spreading through the trees, straight toward Bertome and the others. Wireman laughed.
"Kill whoever you wish, whenever you wish, Gedwin," he said, drawing sword with a flourish. "I use the methods I use, and that's that."
Racing back toward his armsmen, he waved the blade over his head, shouting,
"Santiago! Santiago in glory!"
It was no surprise he did not add a shout for his country to those for his house and his greatest love. Spurring in the same direction, Bertome raised his own voice.
"Saigon and Kyrian!"
No need for sword waving yet.
"Saigon and Kyrian!"
What had the man been after? Thunder rumbled, and Bertome looked to the sky, perplexed. There were a few more clouds than earlier. No. Doyle, Dalin, had mentioned those women. And then he forgot all about whatever the fool tyrant wanted, as steel-veiled Terrabonners poured over the wooded hills toward him, the earth blooming fire and the sky raining lightning ahead of them.
"Saigon and Kyrian!" he shouted.
The wind rose. Horsemen clashed amid thick trees and heavy underbrush, where shadows hung heavily. The light seemed to be failing, the clouds thickening overhead, but it was hard to say with a dense forest canopy for a roof. Booming roars half drowned the ring of steel on steel, the shouts of men, the screams of horses. Sometimes the ground shook. Sometimes the enemy raised shouts.
"Den Lucianos! Den Lucianos and the bees! Annalyn! Rally to Annalyn! Halen! Halen! For the High Lord Suneman!"
The last was the only cry Varric understood in the least, though he suspected any of the locals who named themselves High Lords or Ladies might not be offered the chance to swear the oath. He jerked his sword free from where he had jammed it into his opponent's armpit, just above the breastplate, and let the pale little man topple. A dangerous fighter until he made the mistake of raising his blade too high. The man's bay crashed off through the undergrowth, and Varric spared a moment for regret. The animal looked better than the white-footed dun he was forced to ride. A moment only, and then he was peering through the close-set trees, where it seemed vines dangled from half the branches and bunches of some gray, feathery plant from nearly all. Sounds of battle rose from every direction, but at first he could see nothing that moved. Then a dozen Altaran lances appeared at 50 paces, walking their horses and peering about carefully, though the way they talked loudly among themselves more than justified the red slashes crisscrossing their breastplates. Varric gathered his reins, meaning to take them in. An escort, even this undisciplined rabble, might be the difference between the urgent message he carried reaching Banner General Chiang Mai and not. Black streaks flashed from among the trees, emptying Altaran saddles. Their horses dashed in every direction as the riders fell, and then there were only a dozen corpses sprawled on the damp carpet of dead leaves, at least one crossbow bolt jutting from every man. Nothing moved. Varric shivered in spite of himself. Those foot and blue coats had seemed easy at first, with no pikes to stand behind, but they never came into the open, hiding behind trees, in dips in the ground. They were not the worst. He had been sure after the frantic retreat to the ships at Falma that he had seen the worst he ever could see, the ever-victorious army in a rout. Not half an hour gone, though, he had seen 100 Terrabanners face one lone man in a black coat. 100 lancers against one, and the Terrabanners had been ripped to shreds. Literally ripped to shreds. Men and horses simply exploding as fast as he could count. The slaughter had continued after the Terrabanners turned to flee, went on so long as one of them remained in sight. Perhaps it was really no worse than having the ground erupt beneath your feet, but at least Imani usually left enough of you to be buried. He had been told by the last man he managed to speak to in these woods, a grizzled veteran from home leading 100 Amadisian pikes, that Chiang Mai was in this direction. Ahead, he spotted riderless horses tied to trees and men afoot. Maybe they could give him further direction. And he would give them the lash of his tongue for standing about while a battle raged. When he rode in among them, he forgot tongue lashings. He had found what he was looking for, but not at all what he wanted to find. A dozen badly burned corpses lay in a row. One, his honey-brown face untouched, was recognizably Chiang Mai. The men on their feet were all Terrabanners, Amadisians, Altarans. Some of them were injured, too. The only Seanchan was a tight-faced Suldam, soothing a weeping Damani.
"What happened here?" Varric demanded.
He did not think it was like these Ashaman to leave survivors. Maybe the Suldam had fought him off.
"Madness, my lord."
A hulking Terrabanner shrugged away the man who was spreading ointment down his seared left arm. The sleeve appeared to have been burned away clear to the fellow's breastplate, yet despite his burns, he did not grimace. His veil of steel mail hung by a corner from his red-plumed conical helmet, bearing a hard face, with thick gray mustaches that nearly hid his mouth, and his eyes were insultingly direct.
"A group of Ilianers. They fell on us without warning. At first, all went well. They had none of the black coats with them. Lord Chiang Mai, he led us bravely. And the woman channeled lightnings. Then just as the Ilianas broke the lightnings, they fell among us, too."
He cut off with a significant look at the Suldam. She was on her feet in an instant, shaking her free fist and striding as far toward the Terrabanner as the leash attached to her other wrist would allow. Her Damani lay in a weeping heap.
"I will not hear this dog's words against my Zakai. She is a good Damani, a good Damani."
Varric made soothing gestures to the woman. He had seen Suldam make their charges howl for misdeeds, and a few who crippled the recalcitrant, but most would bristle even at one of the blood who cast aspersions on a favorite. This Terrabanner was not of the blood, and by the look of the quivering Suldam, she was ready to do murder. Had the man voiced his ridiculous, unspoken charge, Varric thought she might have killed him on the spot.
"Prayers for the dead must wait," Varric said bluntly.
What he was about to do would end with him in the hands of the Seekers if he failed, but there was not a Seanchan left standing here except the Suldam.
"I am assuming command. We will disengage and turn south."
"Disengage!" the heavy-shouldered Terrabanner barked. "It will take us days to disengage! The Ilianers, they fight like badgers backed into a corner, the Carianen like ferrets in a box. The Tyrans, they're not so hard as I have heard, but there are maybe a dozen of these Ashaman, yes? I do not even know where 3/4 of my men are in this jolly bag."
Emboldened by his example, the others began giving protest too. Varric ignored them.
and forbore asking what a jolly bag was. Looking at the tangled forest all around him, listening to the clash of battle, the booms of explosions and lightnings, he could imagine.
"You will gather your men and begin pulling back," he said loudly, cutting through their chatter. "Not too fast. You will act in unison."
Mirage's orders to Chiang Mai said with all possible speed. He had memorized them in case something happened to the copy in his saddlebags. All possible speed, but too much speed in this, and half the men would be left behind, chopped to flinders at the enemy's leisure.
"Now move! You fight for the Empress. May she live forever."
That last was the sort of thing you told fresh recruits, but for some reason the listening men jerked as if he had struck them all with his quirt. Bowing quickly and deeply, hands on knees, they all but flew to their horses.
Strange.
Now it was up to him to find the Shonchan units. One of those would be commanded by someone above him, and he could pass his responsibility. The Suldam was on her knees, stroking her still-weeping Damani's hair and crooning softly.
"Get her soothed down," he told her,
with all possible speed. And he thought he had seen a touch of anxiety in Mirage's eyes. What could make Kenna Mirage anxious?
"I think we will be depending on you, Suldam, to the south."
Now why would that make the blood drain from her face? Bashir stood just inside the edge of the trees, frowning through his helmet's face bars at what he saw. His bay nuzzled his shoulder. He held his cloak close against the wind, more to avoid any motion that would draw eyes than for the cold, though that chilled his flesh. It would have been a spring breeze back in Saldaea, but months in the southlands had softened him. Shining bright between gray clouds that sailed along quickly, the sun still lay a little short of midday. And ahead of him. Just because you began a battle facing west did not mean you ended it that way. Before him lay a broad pasture where flocks of black and white goats cropped at the brown grass in desultory fashion, just as if there was no battle raging all around them. Not that there was any sign of it here, for the moment. A man could get himself cut to doll rags crossing that meadow. And in the trees, whether forest or olive groves or thickets, you did not always see the enemy before you were on top of him, scouts or no scouts.
"If we're going to cross," Guayam muttered, rubbing a wide hand over his bald head, "we should cross. Light's truth, we're wasting time."
Amondrid snapped his mouth shut. Likely the moon-faced Kyrianen had been about to say much the same thing. He would agree with a Tyran when horses climbed trees. Jordwin Samaris snorted. The man should have grown a beard to hide that narrow jaw. It made his head look like a forester's splitting wedge.
"I do say go round," he muttered. "I've lost enough men to those light-cursed Damani, and..."
He trailed off with an uneasy glance toward Rochide. The young Ashaman stood by himself, mouth tight, fingering that dragon pin on his collar. Maybe wondering whether it was worth it, by the look of him. There was no knowing air about the boy now, only frowning worry. Leading quick by the reins, Bashir strode to the Ashaman and drew him farther aside in the trees. Pushed him farther aside. Rochide scowled, going reluctantly. The man was tall enough to loom over Bashir, but Bashir was having none of it.
"Can I count on your people next time?" Bashir demanded, jerking a mustache in irritation. "No delays."
Rochide and his fellows seemed to have grown slower and slower responding when they found themselves opposite Damani.
"I know what I'm about, Bashir," Rochide snarled. "Aren't we killing enough of them for you? As far as I can see, we're about done."
Bashir nodded slowly, not in agreement with the last. There were plenty of enemy soldiers left, almost anywhere you looked hard enough. But a good many were dead. He had patterned his movements on what he had studied of the Trolloc Wars, when the forces of the Light seldom came anywhere near the numbers they had to face. Slash at the flanks and run. Slash at the rear and run. Slash and run. And when the enemy chased after, turn on the ground you had chosen beforehand, where the legionmen lay waiting with their crossbows, turn and cut at him until it was time to run again. Or until he broke. Already today he had broken Terrabanners, Amadisians, Altarans, and these Shonchan in their strange armor.
He had seen more enemy dead than in any fight since the Blood Snow. But if he had Ashaman, the other side had those Demani. A good third of his Saldaeans lay dead along the miles behind. Nearly half his force was dead, all told. And there were still more Shanchan out there, with their cursed women, and Terrabanners, and Amadisians, and Altarans. They just kept coming, more appearing as soon as he finished the last. And the Ashaman were growing hesitant. Swinging into Quick's saddle, he rode back to Jordwin and the others.
"We go around,"
he ordered, ignoring Jordwin's nods as much as he did Guayam and Amandrid's scowls.
"Triple scouts ahead. I mean to push hard, but I don't want to trip over a Demani."
No one laughed. Rochide had gathered the other five Ashaman around him, one with a silver sword pinned to his collar, the others without. There had been two more with bear collars when they started out that morning, but if Ashaman knew how to kill, so did Demani. Waving his arms angrily, Rochide appeared to be arguing with them. His face was red, theirs blank and stubborn. Bashir just hoped Rochide could keep all of them from deserting. Today had been costly enough without adding that sort of man wandering about loose. A light rain fell. Rand scowled at the thick black clouds gathering the sky, already beginning to obscure a pale sun halfway down to the far horizon. Light rain now, but it would thicken like those clouds. Irritably, he returned to studying the land ahead of him. The crown of swords pricked his temples. With the power in him, the land was clear as a map despite the weather. Clear enough, anyway. Hills sinking away, some covered with thickets or olive trees, others bare grass or just stone and weeds. He thought he saw movement at the edge of a copse, then again among the rows of an olive orchard on another hill a mile from the copse. Thinking was not enough. Dead men lay across the miles behind, dead enemies. Dead women, too, he knew. But he had stayed away from anywhere Suldam and Demani had died, refused to see their faces. Most thought it was hatred for those who killed so many of his followers. Tideshar frisked a few steps on the hilltop before Rand settled him with a firm hand and the pressure of his knees. A fine thing if a Suldam spotted his movement. The few trees around him were not enough to hide much. Vaguely he realized he did not recognize a one of them. Tideshar tossed his head. Rand tucked the dragon scepter into his saddlebags, just the carved butt end sticking out, to free both hands in case the gelding was not satisfied. He could have taken weariness from the horse with Sayadine, but he knew no way to make it obey with the power. He could not see how the gelding retained enough energy. Sayadine filled him, bubbled in him, but his distantly felt body wanted to sag with weariness. Part of that was the sheer amount of the power he had handled today. Part was the strain of fighting Sayadine to make it do what he wanted. Always Sayadine had to be conquered, forced, but never before like today. The half-healed, never-healing wounds in his left side were agony. The older, an auger trying to drill through the void, the newer, a blaze of raw flame.
"It was an accident, my lord dragon," Adley said suddenly. "I swear it was."
"Shut up and watch," Rand told him harshly.
Adley's eyes sank to his hands on his own reins for a moment, then he raked damp hair out of his face and jerked his head up obediently. Today, here, controlling Sayadine was harder than ever, but letting it slip anytime, anywhere, could kill you. Adley had let it slip, and men had died in uncontrolled bursts of fire, not just the Amadisians he had been aiming at, but near 30 of Ailill's armsmen and almost as many of Anaila's. Except for his slip, Adley would have been with more, with the companions in the woods half a mile to the south. Narishma and Hopwill were with the defenders to the north. Rand wanted Adley under his eye. Had any other accidents happened out of his sight? He could not watch everyone all the time. Flynn's face was grim as day-old death, and Dashiva, far from looking vague, seemed on the point of sweating with concentration. He still muttered to himself under his breath, so low Rand could not hear even with the power in him, but the man mopped rain from his face continually with a sodden lace-edged linen handkerchief that had grown more than grimy as the day wore on. Rand did not think they had slipped. In any case, neither they nor Adley held the power now. nor would until he instructed them to seize it.
"Is it done?" Anaïla asked behind him.
Heedless of who might be watching out there, Rand wheeled Tie-Dye Shar around to face her. The Tyran woman started back in her saddle, the hood of her richly elaborate raincape falling to her shoulders. Her cheek gave a twitch. Her eyes might have been full of fear or hate. At her side, Ailill fingered her reins calmly with red-gloved hands.
"What more can you want?" the smaller woman asked in a cool voice. "A lady being polite to a menial. Barely. If the size of a victory is accounted by dead enemies, I think today alone will put your name in the histories."
"I mean to drive the Shan Chan into the sea!" Rand snapped. Light, he had to finish them now, when he had the chance.
He could not fight the Shan Chan and the Forsaken, and the Light alone knew who or what else all at the same time.
"I did it before, and I will again!"
"Do you have the Horn of Valir hidden in your pocket this time?" Luz Theron asked slyly. Rand snarled at him silently.
"There's someone below," Flynn said suddenly, "riding up this way, from the west."
Rand pulled his mount back around. Legion men ringed the slopes of the hill, though they hid well enough that he seldom caught sight of a blue coat. None of them had a horse. Who would be riding? Bashir's bay trotted up the slope, almost as though it were level ground. Bashir's helmet hung from his saddle, and the man himself looked tired. Without preamble, he spoke in a flat voice.
"We're finished here. Part of fighting is knowing when to go, and it's time. I've left 500 dead behind, near enough, and 2 of your soldiers for salt. I sent 3 more to find Samaradrid, Gregorin, and Wyraman and tell them to rally on you. I doubt they're in any better condition than I am. How does your butcher's bill run?"
Rand ignored the question. His own dead topped Bashir's by close to 200.
"You had no right sending orders to the others. So long as there are 6 Ashaman left, so long as there's me, I have enough. I mean to find the rest of the Shan Chan army and destroy it, Bashir. I won't let them add Altara to Terabon and Amadisia."
Bashir knuckled his thick mustaches with a wry laugh.
"You want to find them? Look out there."
He swept a gauntleted hand across the hills to the west.
"I can't point to a particular spot, but there are 10, maybe 15,000 close enough to see from here, if those trees weren't in the way. I danced with the Dark One getting through them unseen to reach you. Maybe 100 Demani down there, maybe more. More coming for sure, and more men. Seems their general has decided to concentrate on you. I suppose it isn't always cheese and ale, being Tavirin."
"If they're out there..."
Rand scanned the hills. The rain fell more heavily. Where had he seen movement? Light, he was tired. Sayadin hammered at him. Unconsciously, he touched the wrapped bundle beneath his stirrup leather. His hand jerked away of its own accord. 10,000, even 15. Once Samaradrid reached him, and Gregorin and Wyraman, more important, once the rest of the Ashaman did. "If they're out there, that's where I'll destroy them, Bashir. I'll hit them from all sides, the way we intended in the first place."
Frowning, Bashir reined his horse closer until his knee almost touched Rand's. Flynn moved his mount away, but Adlai was too focused on staring through the rain to notice anything so near, and Dashiva, still wiping his face incessantly, stared with open interest. Bashir lowered his voice to a murmur.
"You aren't thinking straight. That was a good plan in the beginning, but their general thinks fast. He spread out to blunt our attacks before we could fall on him spread out marching. We've cost him even so, it seems, and he's now pulling everything together. You won't catch him by surprise. He wants us to come at him. He's out there waiting for it. Ashaman or no Ashaman, if we stand nose to nose with this fellow, I think maybe the vultures grow fat and nobody rides away."
"Nobody stands nose to nose with the Dragon Reborn," Rand growled. "The Forsaken could tell him that. Whoever he is. Right, Flynn? Dashiva?" Flynn nodded uncertainly. Dashiva flinched. "You think I can't surprise him, Bashir?
Watch!
Pulling the long bundle loose, he stripped away the cloth covering, and Rand heard gasps as raindrops glistened on a sword seemingly made of crystal. The sword that is not a sword.
Let's see if he's surprised by Kalendor in the hands of the Dragon Reborn, Bashir!
Cradling the translucent blade in the crook of his elbow, Rand rode Tidashar forward a few steps. There was no reason to. He had no clearer view from there. Except something spidered across the outer surface of the void, a wriggling black web. He was afraid. The last time he had used Kalendor, really used it, he had tried to bring the dead back to life. He had been sure he could do anything then, anything at all, like a madman thinking he could fly. But he was the Dragon Reborn. He could do anything. Had he not proved it time and again? He reached for the source through the sword that is not a sword. Saiyadin seemed to leap into Kalendor before he touched the source through it. From pommel to point, the crystal sword shone with a white light. He'd only thought the power filled him before. Now he held more than 10 men could have unaided. 100. He did not know how many. The fires of the sun searing through his head, the cold of all the winters of all the ages eating into his heart. In that torrent, the taint was all the midden heaps in the world emptying into his soul. Saiyadin still tried to kill him, tried to scour away, burn away, freeze away every scrap of him. But he fought, and he lived for a moment more, and another moment, another. He wanted to laugh. He could do anything. Once, holding Kalendor, he had made a weapon that searched out Shadowspawn through the Stone of Tyr, struck them dead with hunting lightning wherever they stood or ran or hid. Surely there must be something like that to use against his enemies here. But when he called to Luz Theron, only anguished whimpers answered, as if that disembodied voice feared the pain of Saiyadin. With Kalendor blazing in his hand, he did not remember raising the blade overhead. He stared at the hills where his enemies hid. They were gray now, with thickening rain, and dense black clouds blocking the sun. What was it he had told Egan Padros?
"I am the storm,"
he whispered, a shout in his ears, a roar. And he channeled. Overhead the clouds boiled. Where they had been the black of soot, they became midnight, the heart of midnight. He did not know what he was channeling. So often he did not, in spite of Asmodean's teaching. Maybe Luz Theron was guiding him, in spite of the man's weeping. Flows of Saiyadin spun across the sky, wind and water and fire. Fire. The sky truly did rain lightning. 100 bolts at once. Hundreds. Forked blue-white shafts, stabbing down as far as he could see. The hills before him erupted. Some flew apart under the torrent of lightning like kicked anthills. Flames sprang up in thickets, trees turning to torches in the rain, flames racing through olive orchards. Something struck him hard, and he realized he was picking himself up from the ground. The crown had fallen from his head. Kalendor still blazed in his hand, though. Vaguely he was aware of Tidashar scrambling to his feet, trembling. So they thought to strike back at him, did they? Shoving Kalendor high, he screamed at them,
"Come against me if you dare! I am the storm! Come if you dare, Shaitan! I am the Dragon Reborn!"
1,000 sizzling lightning bolts hailed down from the clouds. Again something struck him down. He tried to fight up again. Kalendor, still shining, lay a pace from his outstretched hand. The sky shattered with lightnings. Suddenly he realized that the way to top him was Bashir, that the man was shaking him. It must have been Bashir who had flung him down.
"Stop it!"
the Saldaean shouted. Blood fanned down his face from a split across his scalp.
"You're killing us, man! Stop!"
Rand turned his head, and one stunned look was enough. Lightnings flashed all around him, in every direction. A bolt stabbed down onto the reverse slope, where Denharad and the armsmen were. The screams of men and horses rose. Anaela and Ailil were both afoot, trying vainly to quiet mounts that reared, eyes rolling, trying to rip reins free. Flynn was bending over someone, not far from a dead horse with legs already stiff. Rand let Saiyadin go. He let it go, but for moments it still flowed into him, and lightning raged. The flow into him dwindled, tailed off, and vanished. Dizziness swept through him in its place. For three more heartbeats, two of Kalandor shone where they lay on the ground, and lightning fell. Then, silence except for the rising drum of the rain, and the screams from behind the hill. Slowly Bashir climbed off of him, and Rand rose, unaided on his tottering legs, blinking as his sight returned to normal. The Saldaean watched him as he might have a rabid lion, fingering his sword hilt. Annihila took one look at Rand on his feet and collapsed in a faint. Her horse dashed away, reins dangling. Ailill, still fighting a rearing animal, spared few glances for Rand. Rand let Kalandar lie where it was for the moment. He was not sure he dared pick it up. Not yet. Flynn straightened, shaking his head, then stood silently as Rand went unsteadily to stand beside him. The rain fell on Jonan Adley's sightless eyes, bulging as if in horror. Jonan had been one of the first. Those screams from behind the hill seemed to slice through the rain. How many more? Rand wondered. Among the defenders, the companions, among... Rain thick as a blanket hid the hills where the Seanchan army lay. Had he hurt them at all, striking out blindly? Or were they still waiting out there with all their demoni, waiting to see how many more of his own he could kill for them? Set whatever guard you think we need, Rand told Bashir. His voice was iron. One of the first. His heart was iron. When Gregorin and the others reach us, we'll travel to where the carts are waiting as fast as we can. Bashir nodded without speaking and turned away in the rain.
I've lost, Rand thought dully. I'm the dragon reborn, but for the first time, I've lost.
Suddenly, Luz Theron raged up inside him, sly digs forgotten.
I've never been defeated, he snarled. I am the Lord of the Morning. No one can defeat me.
Rand sat in the rain, turning the crown of swords in his hands, looking at Kalandor lying in the mud. He let Luz Theron rage. Abeldar Yulan wept, grateful for the downpour that hid the tears on his cheeks. Someone would have to give the order. Eventually, someone would have to apologize to the Empress, might she live forever, and maybe to Suroth sooner. Those were not why he wept, though, nor even for a dead comrade. Roughly ripping a sleeve from his coat, he laid it across Mirage's staring eyes, so the rain would not fall on them.
"Send out orders for retreat," Yulan ordered, and saw the men standing around him jerk.
For the second time on these shores, the ever-victorious army had suffered a devastating defeat, and Yulan did not think he was the only one who wept.